Welcome, everyone. We will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Today we are, we don't have the necessary paperwork for the last two bills, so we will roll over Senate Bill 984 and House Bill 2238 to our next meeting. So we will start today by opening a work session on House Bill 3017. Christine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3017 would extend the sunset date for enterprise zones from June 30th, 2013 to June 30th, 2025. It also changes the date for long-term rural enterprise zones for that same time period. The amendment in the House removed the sunset extension for the income tax credit associated with the long-term rural enterprise zones for any businesses obtaining certification after June 30th, 2012. There is a revenue impact statement on this measure. It's a small amount of the $62.1 million that's spent in a biennium on the program at first, and that would be progressively higher until it reaches that amount. And there is a finding of minimal expenditure impact for a fiscal impact on this measure.
Okay, and we had a public hearing on this, and we had no amendments. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3017A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 3017A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Telfer, would you like to carry this?
Certainly.
Okay, now we will open a public hearing on our marquee attraction today, House Bill 2541.
Chair Reddick and members of the committee, House Bill 2541A is the is another non-controversial softball that I bring you. Focus here. The House Bill 2541 comes to you from the House side, from House Revenue Committee. This bill is the major rewrite of the state tax, state/inheritance tax. Comes as a culmination of work that has been going on for the better part of about 2 years. It started in the 2009 session with the task of rewriting these laws, the state/inheritance tax laws, was sent to the Oregon Law Commission by the legislature, by mostly the House Revenue and also the Senate Revenue Committee. And it took a group of work task force that started working on this for a while. And today, I won't go through much for now, but it will bring the Oregon Law Commission that they could go through the outcome that they're bringing in this bill. And probably after we look at the and hear the other testimony and so on, we could work into some of the other material that I've put in your packet and the revenue impact if you want to go with it. But for now, in order to be able to parse this bill and look at what introductions and what new and what's different, I think the Oregon Law Commission Chair, Lynn Shirley, and the Executive Director and the Deputy Executive Director are here all to walk you through that introduction.
Okay, let's start out with our Law Commission representatives today. We've got Wendy Johnson, Lane Shetterly, and Jeff Dobius.
Dobbins.
This is a U on here. We're sending you to penmanship school.
we'll blame it on Wendy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good to be with you again today. Lane Shetterly here in my capacity today as chair of the Oregon Law Commission and chair of the work group that put together the Law Commission's recommendation and what is now before you is House Bill 2541. I will just make a few comments, then I'll turn it over to Wendy to walk you through some of the technical elements of the bill, and then Jeff has some comments on revenue impact, of the bill as well, and then, of course, we'll be happy to answer questions at any time along the way. Just a couple of things about this. You have been distributed a copy of our work group report. On the inside of that, it identifies who the members were of the work group and advisors and interested persons who participated as well. You can see that this was a broadly representative group with lots of people involved in the development over the past couple of years. I will also say that the general outline of it is very much the same as what I have brought to you over the past 2 years, where we have periodically come in to report on the progress of the work group, and the basic elements being an increase in the exemption amount to $1.5 million, making it a true exemption. By our count, over the past, I think back since 2002, of about 10,000 estates filed, that would exempt about 4,000 people from filing returns, that increase from 1 million to 1.5 million. And then instead of the current structure that we have now, where as soon as you are taxed, as soon as you get over that $1 million threshold, you pay your tax on the estate back to the first dollar. So you go from zero to about $33,000 when you cross the threshold of that $1 million estate. In this case, we're raising that threshold to $1.5 million, and then we are starting a ramp in tax from there. So you begin to pay tax on amounts over that $1.5 million threshold. Consequence of that, we've increased the rates on the upper end of estates, of course, because the directive from the committees was to maintain rough revenue neutrality in the work that we have done. In raising those rates, I think we are at 19.8. On the top, we were cognizant of Washington's rates, since they're the only other state in the neighborhood that has an estate tax, and I think their estate tax top rate was 19.2%. So we wanted to keep ourselves in rough parity with Washington so that we didn't get too far out from our neighbor state to the north on those upper ends. But that essentially is how we've maintained revenue neutrality. Keeping in mind, of course, that the states now over $5 million have an exemption under federal law, and over $5 million where they be under $5 million have the exemption, and over $5 million when they start to pay, they do have a deduction for state estate taxes that they've paid, and so the feds will help to pay some of that additional tax on those larger estates. Just a couple other things from me, and then I'll turn it over to Wendy. One is the vote by which this bill passed the House. Mazin mentioned it was a fairly close vote, 35 to 24. A couple of significant things about that I think are just worth noting. It was a bipartisan vote, both in favor and against. And so in the realm of tax policy, my experience, that is a commendation of sorts of the bill to have bipartisan support and opposition for a bill. I think it was you had some on one side who simply want to abolish the inheritance tax, and, of course, that was not the charge of this work group from the committees. It was to rewrite the inheritance tax. And on the other side, there were those concerned about the revenue impact. I think Mazin's revenue impact statement on the House side showed $700,000 lost revenue. Jeff will give you more of the details on that, but I would just point out that I have said in every report that I presented to the committee that we regard revenue neutrality not as a number but as a range because of the volatility of the estate tax. Sheet that Jeff will go over with you shows that this tax has a standard deviation of $24.2 million. That's one standard deviation. in terms of dollars collected. And I would regard that a $700,000 impact on a complete rewrite of the estate tax is a pretty darn close hit to the target of revenue neutrality. Without, if you're going to change it, it would be difficult to change it without having some impact. And we thought that that impact was certainly in keeping with the broad directive to maintain general revenue neutrality, understanding the volatility of this particular tax. With that, I will pass it over to Wendy to walk you through point by point some of the highlights of the bill. I know we do have other people who seem to want to talk about it, which was odd. In the House, nobody did. but it seems to have picked up some interest along the way, so we're happy to have that. And we do want to leave time for those people to testify as well as to answer your questions.
Okay. Thank you. Before you go on, literally there was no testimony in the
House? I wouldn't say that. No, that was
it. Minimal.
It was minimal testimony. That's correct.
All right. Thank you. Welcome, Wendy.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission. I staffed this project along with my colleague Jeff Dobbins. I will be speaking from what I've called the summary, the Inheritance Law Reform Bill summary. So you have three documents before you, the full work group report that details where we've been and what all the details of this bill do, and then you have this summary, and then you also have this one-page chart. So I'll be going through the summary, focusing just on the first three pages. I feel like the last pages, they're important changes to the law, but they're more technical in nature. The first three pages are really the policy changes. So, of course, the first, number one, is just to sort of get the picture of what this is. Oregon has always had essentially an estate tax. It's the estate that's taxed. It's not the heirs that receive the inheritance. And so we're just changing the nomenclature, but it's not a substantive change at all. There's been some commentary in the newspapers that have confused that, but we've always had an estate tax, and so we're just changing the name. Number two on the list is a significant change. We have been tied to an old Internal Revenue Code, the federal code, dating back to 2000, since Congress made significant changes. And so this, because of what recently happened in Congress at the end of December, we're able to link up to the new code because of the changes the bill makes. And so for the first time, CPAs and attorneys will actually be able to buy a new code and be able to figure out Oregon's estate tax much easier. So we'll be tied to the December 31st, 2010 Internal Revenue Code. The third point is one that Lane's talked about already. We're raising, with this bill, we'd raise the threshold for when an estate tax is due from $1 million to $1.5 million. If you take a look at Section 8 of the bill, on page 13, you'll see that we had been raising the threshold every year in Oregon. In 2003, it was $700,000. 2004, it was $850,000. Then 2005, it was $950,000. And then 2006, it was $1 million. And we have not raised it since 2006. It's when all the phase out with Congress had changed. So we haven't done an increase in a long time, and we were at a lower threshold in many states. And for a bunch of other reasons, it would help with auditing issues as well. But it would, by raising it $500,000, we would take a lot of estates off the table and deal with some of the natural resource issues as well. So it is an increase to 1.5. And that also is more competitive with Washington's, which is at a $2 million threshold. By rewriting the whole chapter, we're now introducing an Oregon taxable estate term, and we use that throughout the chapter to make it an actual Oregon state estate rather than always relying on the federal, and we use that term throughout. So you'll see that new term, and it's defined. Number five in the summary, you'll see that there's now a tax rate table, and that's on page 3 of the bill. Since we've had an estate tax, we have not had an actual rate schedule in Oregon law. We've had to rely on the federal credit that would have been allowed on the federal return. So you have to go find two schedules in the 2000 code and then figure out what your actual rate is. And so now it will be actually in state law what the state estate tax rate schedule is, which makes it easier to find, but also it makes it easier for you to change in the future to adjust. And it also makes it actually able for a citizen to look at the tax code, Oregon's tax code, and figure out what their estate tax would actually be. It's a progressive rate with a ramp, and you see that in the schedule, that it's from, for example, on line 15 on page 3, it's from 0 to 1 million, the tax is 0, but then after that it's 10.5. So you're showing that it's a ramp. It's not those dollars from 0 to the 1.5 million. It's those dollars that are over the threshold. So that makes the ramp. By using the old federal schedule, it was a cliff. As soon as you hit the threshold, then it taxed the whole estate. So this is changing that to a ramp structure. Moving on to, well, number 7 actually is important. The rate schedule might look high at first blush. The 19.8 on the top end is higher than what we have now. But as Lane explained, those estates that have a federal estate tax due, those which have estates over $5 million, those estates would get 35% of their Oregon taxes paid as a credit on their federal return. So, in effect, the federal government is helping to pay the Oregon state estate tax because they get that deduction on their federal return. Estates that are less than $5 million don't have a federal tax due, so they're not getting that rebate back, essentially. But that made us more comfortable by raising the top end because they would be getting a credit back.
Can you take a quick question here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that question, what does California do? When I know Washington and Oregon, you could compare. What does California do? And given that what you just said, the federal and the credit, there wouldn't be any advantage to moving to California.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, actually, California doesn't have an estate tax.
That's what I mean. So.
The advantage is already there to move to California if you're going to do it, because you can go from a taxable estate of $1 million and above to no estate tax by moving to California. So,
but you still have the federal.
You still have the federal. That's correct. Yeah, that's going to apply no matter what state. But again, in our, I think, west of the Rockies, it's only Oregon and Washington that even have an estate tax.
Moving on to number 8 and number 9, those are just dealing with meritable property. We're just making it clear what those provisions mean, and not necessarily substantive changes, but then also making it very clear that your meritable election for federal and state are separate elections and that you can make different elections on each return. And then numbers 10, 11, and 12 are regarding intangible property. This is, we're talking about stocks, bank accounts, it could be LLCs, those types of things. We spent a lot of time discussing those issues, and in the end, the work group recommends and the bill reflects that there would no longer be a tax on intangible property of non-residents. And for residents, if that intangible property would be taxed in another state, then we would not tax that intangible property either. Constitutionally, you can't double tax personal property or real property, but feds have never been able to figure out intangibles either, and so you can be double taxed in multiple states on that same intangible property. And so states have tried to use reciprocal exemptions and things, but because so many states have repealed their estate tax, that those reciprocal provisions don't work anymore. And so we're just stating that if you would be taxed in another state, or you actually are, then you would not be taxed in Oregon for that same property. And then the next set of provisions, numbers 13 all the way through 26, are all regarding the natural resource property area. Oregon is one of the few states that has a separate set of, it's a credit actually for dealing with natural resource property, and by that I'm talking about farms, nurseries, forest land, and fishing businesses. We've provided presently a credit for those estates to elect property that's in one of those categories as basically a credit on what their tax owed, and that would continue. We've just really cleaned up what those provisions are, what the requirements are, and going forward how those provisions work. So I'll just quickly walk you through those again. We've clarified what the definition is. There wasn't a lot of detail in the law, and we've really defined that in Section 7 of the bill. And then we're taking out the schedule that is in present law, instead putting in a formula. And that formula is one that looks at how much natural resource property you're electing versus how much your whole estate is. So it's a ratio. Presently, it's just a schedule, so however much natural resource property you look on the schedule, and that's how much you get. So the value doesn't necessarily help the estates that we're really trying to help, which are the land-rich, cash-poor type. It was viewed as not as helpful. And it's also more complicated and a little game playing and such. So this is a different formula, but it's also harder to calculate mathematically how it's all going to work out. But it's a schedule. It's a formula. And the formula would cap it, though. The most you could elect would be $6 million. You may remember that you couldn't even qualify for the credit unless your estate was less than $15 million. So it's smaller estates, but even then, the largest estates could only claim up to $6 million. They couldn't claim all $15 million. So they're still, even those $15 million estates would be paying a tax on $9 million at least.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, that $6 million really relates to what the $7.5 million that's in current law. You've got a $15 million maximum size estate. You can elect up to 50% of that, which is 7.5. $6 million is 7.5 million minus the 1.5 million exclusion that everybody gets. And so that's why that number has come down to $6 million, because everybody already gets the $1.5 million exclusion.
Then moving on, number 16 is just saying when you have this overlap of natural resource property and marital property, you can make different elections on your federal return and state return. And then number 17 is regarding working capital. We know that this has been an issue that has been vexing to both the House and Senate Revenue Committees. We deleted that term altogether, because working capital is sort of this concept of assets and liabilities, and you have to figure it out for each estate. And would require tax returns for many years and just how that business worked. We saw that as really unworkable, and so what this bill does is uses the term operating allowance, which is basically saying we recognize these businesses have to have money to operate, and we're going to allow allowance that you can elect cash or cash equivalents, and that allowance is another formula. The most you could elect would be 20% of your other natural resource property, but in no case higher than $1.5 million. Most estates aren't electing this anyway because you have to have cash or cash equivalents, and that's not very common. But we were also putting sideboards on it by saying if you elect that cash, you have to use it for that business for 5 years, just like you do for the real property as well. So there's some disincentives to electing too much cash because you can't go on that vacation or use it for your kids' tuition or whatever. It has to be used back in the business. So there's some protections on that. And you have to, under this bill, you have to actually track that money that you have elected. So it is 20%. Sometimes that might, in very rare cases, I suppose it could be more than you would be allowed under this assets minus liabilities. But it's pretty much rough estimate of what makes sense to run the business.
And if I could on this too, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the idea here is to try and deal with just a real wide variance of cash needs and timing issues in natural resource estates. You might have an estate that is predominantly forest land. Owner dies while the trees are growing before they've been harvested, and there's lots of value in the land and the trees. If the owner dies after the trees have been harvested, now you don't have much value. The crop essentially has been harvested, and the value of that credit has been substantially diminished. But you still have, essentially, it's natural resource property. The character of the property hasn't changed. And so this recognizes that those trees may have been converted to cash, but we're still going to recognize that it's all part of a natural resource business operation, and that it's going to take cash to reinvest in the property, put trees back in the ground, and continue the operation of that business. And so by using the operating allowance, it's designed to accommodate both the variability of the cash needs in the natural resource business types and also the timing issues that can arise relative to the timing of the death of the owner and the status of the crops on the ground, for instance.
Moving then on to number 18, the present law seems to have a look back on all the property, so the chickens, the real property, or whatever, and it just didn't make a lot of sense to have a look back on
a 5-year look back.
Yeah, a 5-year look back on personal property. I mean, you shouldn't. Some of those pieces of equipment and livestock just aren't, you know, they don't last that long. So this bill redoes it and says, okay, for real property, you have to have had it for 5 years to be able to elect it as natural resource, but not for personal property. But looking forward, you do, if you claim personal property or real property or the cash, all of that is restricted to that 5 years. It has to be used for 5 out of 8 years. And it seemed to be missing personal property on the look forward in existing law. So we've just kind of cleaned up that whole area, and then also dealing with replacement property. It wasn't detailed on if you've elected, let's say, the chickens, and then you sell them, or you've elected a tractor, and then you get that tractor breaks down. It didn't seem to allow you to replace it very well. And so this, if you elect it, you can replace it. As long as you replace it with other natural resource property, you won't have a tax due because you didn't keep it for that 5 years. But we put in a restriction on real property, because land seemed to be an important key to this whole credit, is if you did elect real property, you couldn't sell that real property off for cash or use it to buy a combine or whatever. You had to use real property to switch and replace it with other real property.
You said involuntary conversions. What did you have in mind? That they'd have a little bit longer to convert? What would be in that category?
Chair Birding, members of the committee, that's when you're talking about a condemnation, or the government takes the property for some other reason that you weren't planning on selling it, but it's involuntarily been converted.
Okay. So, but even then, you have to get it back into natural resources property.
The proceeds from that, you'd have to, right.
Okay.
But we do allow more time there because we assume that it's not part of a strategic decision that you've been planning.
And those provisions actually track with federal regulations regarding involuntary conversions, so we've given them the same amount of time there.
Okay.
We've explained more of the fishing business requirement. To our knowledge, there hasn't been anyone who's taken that credit for fishing business, but we've put in more similar restrictions of having to have the fishing business for 5 years and then having to have a boat, similar to having to have property. We've kind of just spelled out that a little bit more. So that's also in the bill, and put on the same restrictions on the 5-year look forward. So that's really pretty much the natural resource credit area. The last page of the summary is more technical provisions. We put in a statute of limitations. We've dealt with interest issues. Some technical terms required reporting, details on the how you reached your appraisal values and what property you've elected on the natural resource credit. Just more things to help the Department of Revenue enforce the area. But with that, I would take any questions and turn it over to deal with more of the numbers.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank you for all the work on this. This has been quite a project. If you look at the committee, if you look at the work group members, they covered the waterfront, as it were, in the work group, and spent a tremendous amount of time. One of my questions is, what are the consequences of not doing some of these technical changes? In other words, what's the consequence of doing nothing? Where are we coming to harm by doing nothing?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess the do nothing is just more of the same. Of course, every year that connection with that 2000 federal schedule gets more and more tenuous and difficult for new practitioners to find. That's one of the reasons we wanted to create our own, so that we weren't tied to this fading connection to federal tax law. You're doing nothing. You'd still be left with, frankly, a mess in the natural resource credit. If anything, not only does our product here identify amendments, but we've also highlighted some I think significant issues in the natural resource credit and just the administration of that and how it works. Then you, again, obviously, if you do nothing, you still have the scenario that you have now, where a tax an estate goes from zero to $33,000 in tax on the basis of that step over from under $1 million to over $1 million. That was considered to be kind of a problematic structure of the tax from the committees that assigned it to us. So, you know, to do nothing, you just continue on with sort of the bubblegum and duct tape system that we have now, is basically what you have.
Thank you. Senator Telfer.
Oh, thank you. And with that, Lane, it gives me a question, because as one who does this estate planning as well as the various forms, the fading, well, that's what we have, and so we know it. This, you know, obviously would be something new, and we'd have to relearn or rework a lot of state plans. So, but given that, and looking at the work group and seeing no CPAs listed, what was your interface with the OSCPA or individual practitioners that deal feet on the ground with this?
There is a CPA.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
I was just looking at the commissioners on the, see if they're.
No, there's a Clint Bent. Turn to page 3 of that.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
So you had one?
We had CPA. Clint is here, and
yeah,
can probably tell you about his communication with the CPA Association. I will also say, of course, that the attorneys here are attorneys who also practice in that tax and so have particular knowledge of the accounting principles behind the estate tax as well.
Follow-up. But my concern would be more some of the valuation techniques and some of those issues that the attorneys may probably not have insight into.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, again, on that, I'll bet Clint is just itching to get up here and tell you all about that. Of course, on valuation, too, we had the help of the department. Deborah Buchanan from the department was able to communicate the valuation issues and other compliance issues from the department's perspective as well. And we had, I thought, very valuable input from Peggy Woolsey, who used to be a compliance auditor with the inheritance tax section. So we had some of those practical perspectives as well. But Clint was particularly the representative of the CPAs. And my understanding is that this has been communicated to the association. And again, I'll let Clint respond to that more fully.
Other questions? Let's see.
We did have just a little bit more from Jeff Dobbins.
I thought you were here to answer questions. Welcome.
No problem. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Jeff Dobbins, Executive Director of the Law Commission. I just wanted to say a few words sort of overall, and I'm going to base my testimony on this the chart that has the color chart on the bottom. And the overall point that I wanted to make here is just an overall perspective on the nature of the estate tax as it's existed in Oregon over the course of the last several years. And as Lane mentioned, the tax itself has been very volatile as far as the amount of money that comes in from a year-to-year basis. And so it makes the effort to try and come up with what amounts to a revenue-neutral number difficult. And legislative revenue, and MAS in particular, worked a lot with us to try and come up with what those numbers looked like. The other thing that I wanted to point out from this perspective is the role of the natural resource property credit in the overall scheme of the inheritance tax. And as you'll see by the chart, the blue is the total amount of tax that was collected in each of the years, and beginning in 2007 with the natural resource property credit, you see the relatively small effect of the natural resource property credit that was given. And so even though a huge amount of work and a lot of time went in, and of course it's very important for the people that this affects, the number in the overall scheme of things is relatively small, particularly when you take into account the overall volatility of the tax numbers in general. The other thing that I wanted to point out is the fact that we recognize that that there is a revenue impact associated with this, and I wanted to acknowledge the work of legislative revenue that went into trying to come up with this number, because it's a difficult number to come up with. The amount that's there, as I understand it, and I'm sure Mazin will go into this in some detail, is a number that's intended to sort of represent what the change in the calculation of the natural resource credit is going to do, but it's trying to do it in sort of this hypothetical world where nothing else changes. The problem with so many of the changes that the Law Commission was making and that the work group was proposing over time is you push one thing and something else bumps out on the other side. Very typical of sort of, you know, we're working within the overall constraint of maintaining a revenue neutrality, but if you, you know, change the exemption amount, then you're going to have some effect on the natural resource credit. And it's interesting because if you actually actually go back and calculate what the credit under existing law would have looked like or looked like for all of the estates that had natural resource credit that was claimed in 2007 to 2009. And then you go back and you calculate what the natural resource credit amount would be under the proposed law. That credit amount actually comes down a little bit for the existing estates. But because of the intersection with this sort of hypothetical world, it ends up having what amounts to a revenue impact. The overall point, again, that I'm trying to make, though, is that these numbers are relatively small in the overall effort. And really what the Law Commission has been trying to do here is do its best to sort of reach a rough justice to try and hit the numbers of revenue neutrality, but given those restrictions, to really make the law more streamlined, to get rid of areas where there are disincentives or bad incentives to individuals as far as the way that estates are managed, and to try and avoid problems, both problems that have been highlighted by the tax system as it exists and problems going forward into the future. And there's a lot of changes, of course, that the committee can make on a policy basis, changing the rate tables and changing exclusion amounts and so on and so forth. But every time you push one, something else has to change in order to maintain those revenue neutrality levels. And this is really sort of the best effort of the work group and the Law Commission generally to come up with sort of the optimum solution given the charges from the committee.
Thank you. On what basis did you choose the $1.5 million for the upper threshold?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it was there's several factors went into that. Again, Wendy mentioned that we have over the years stepped up that exemption amount in Oregon, and so this seemed to be in keeping with that evolution. Of course, as we were working, the federal estate tax went away, and then it came back with an exemption of $5 million, which was up from its last exemption of 3.5. So we were watching that moving continually further away from where we are and having a sense that we want to manage that gap between our exemption amount and theirs, but recognizing there's no way that we could equal that $5 million exemption, or you'd end up just it'd be an onerous tax on the few estates in Oregon that would still have any tax liability. But we were cognizant of that. Also, we were cognizant of the Washington $2 million exemption, a little bit of, again, competition or wanting to really not create competition or to limit competition between Oregon and Washington, since we are the only two states together that have the estate tax, and thinking that, again, to go all the way to $2 million, we looked at that, but the impact of that on the upper end of states was greater than we thought was good or feasible to do, and so we fell back to the 1.5. It's still closer to that $2 million and makes it a little bit more competitive. And then the other is that we have, I think, a compliance staff in the department of one or two, I think, in the department. And so it's a nod to compliance. We think that just anecdotally, and it's nothing more than anecdotal and just a hunch, but I'm going to guess it's right, that there's a lot of tax that doesn't get collected on estates, you know, smaller estates that may be taxable, but not much over $1 million. Either people don't know that they have to file or they just don't file. We don't have a compliance system that's in place to catch those. And so we thought that, again, in the scheme of things, raising that threshold to $1.5 million, that means $3 million for couples. You're more likely to capture those estates that are going to be more sophisticated and have the attorneys and the accountants planning for them. And because of that, we'll be have a higher likelihood of compliance with those estates as well. And so we thought that by moving out those smaller taxable estates between the million and $1.5 million, that we actually could increase compliance without having to increase staffing for compliance. And so it really was a combination of all of those things, Madam Chair, that went into the move to $1.5 million. I think I've covered all the points, but those, it was all just part of that. Could it have been 1.3, yeah, or 1.7? But, 1.5 just was
and
what
then, And then on the rates themselves, how do those, our top rate goes into effect, I see, after $8 million. How does that compare to Washington?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the rates essentially came from Mazin. I don't think the committee itself ever set rates. We never set a rate. We set basically the structure that we wanted to have it look like this, and we wanted to maintain rough revenue neutrality. And really, those rates are from Mazin. So we relied on his work in actually getting the rate schedule. But again, keeping in mind that we did want to maintain at least some parity with Washington, close parity on the top rate, which is the 19.8 versus 19.2.
Okay. All right. That was my question. There's this 19.2.
There's this. It's 19, I think. The idea is to keep the top rate competitive because, of course, the lower rate is obviously they have the 2 million exemption and we don't. So the idea was to at least not go over what they have in order not to make them more attractive than we are. So because they have an advantage on one side rather than the other. But we can go more into the rate setting.
Okay. First of all, I want to give Senator Haas a chance to ask a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get back to this 35% federal deduction for states over $5 million. Mm-hmm. So for, say, hypothetically a $10 million state, what would that mean in Oregon under this versus California total bill? Because you have that credit there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Haas, with the it's kind of apples and oranges, but in Oregon, that $10 million estate would owe on the federal return, and they'd owe on the Oregon return. It's just that when they pay the federal tax, they'd get a deduction of 35% of what they paid of state tax.
Okay.
So it's helped. They're getting a break on their state return. California, there is no state return, so they still have to pay their federal tax, but they owe nothing for California state tax.
I see.
So it's just helping. The net result for the Oregon taxpayer is that it's really not 19.8% because they're getting 35% of it back.
And that's why you say it's more modest than it appears.
Correct.
Because of that deduction. Yeah.
And, of course, that would also apply in Washington. Washington would also get that
deduction. That's correct.
Senator Morris.
For the layperson on the panel, it would be helpful if we had California and Arizona and Nevada and Oregon and Washington, the effective tax, actual tax paid based on the states, and maybe use a 2 million increment to just understand, given the deductions, to understand how great is the lure to establish residency in the wintertime for a couple that is mobile, has a large estate, and they establish residency where the sun shines and you actually enjoy the winter. How great is that lure to do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, it's an interesting question. Of course, in part, first of all, since there's no estate tax in Arizona, Nevada, no state estate tax in Arizona, Nevada, or California, that'd be an easy comparison. You'd add the federal tax plus the Oregon tax, and the amount of the Oregon tax would be the difference in every case. Comparing Washington, that would be instructive at different rates or different sizes of a state. But even there, you'd have to make assumptions as to is it a natural resource estate? If so, how much a natural resource estate? You could find those hypotheticals and compare them, and that'd be useful. And I think in depending on the size of the estate, the lower estates will pay less in Oregon, and they'll pay more than in Washington, and they'll pay more than Washington, the larger estates, because of that larger rate at the top. But the numbers, we'd have to actually run the numbers to get those.
Yeah.
Chair Berger, just to Senator Morse, just to reiterate Lane's point, this is something that we talked about a fair amount during the course of the work group, is this attentiveness to the incentives that changes in rates might provide to people that are under these systems. And I think that one of the conclusions that we reached was we're already in a world where people in Oregon and Washington pay estate taxes and people that are in other states don't. And so to the degree that that's a critical factor, that's going to be have driven people away already. Now, on the margins, yeah, there may be small effects, and we can certainly get comparisons, but to the degree that somebody's going to be motivated by the amount of a given estate tax in a given state, I think a big bulk of those changes have been made already.
Senator Tupper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But the difference would be now estates with more than $3.6 million will pay more than they are currently paying. Is that not correct? I think that's what
Right. Yes, right. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right, Senator. Right. And I think the point is, and I don't disagree that there may be a marginal change in incentives. And the question is just whether that marginal change is enough to flip the limit when there's already a very substantial change from, moving from Oregon to Arizona or Oregon to Washington or something like that.
Senator Morse.
To follow up, thank you, Madam Chair. There is a bit of a cumulative effect that history would not reflect.
Yeah.
And that is the changes in the tax code, marginal tax rate, and the capital gains rate. And then you add another marginal change on the estate tax. Again, how great is that lure to change residency? And I think that's a very valid concern.
And Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, another point. There was a lot of the assets can't change. You can only be taxed on your real property in the state where it is. So unless you put it into an LLC, that incentive doesn't really work because you can't move it to Arizona. So it depends on where your wealth is, on whether you can be lured away. So that's hard to calculate where that tax could be lured to because some of it's not movable.
And if I may, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, too, keep in mind that in the numbers of estates filed where we have raised the threshold from $1 million to $1.5 million, and then the crossover point around $3.6 million, if you look at the chart that Jeff showed you, you can see that the number of returns, let's say, over the last 10 years, in that $1 million to $1.5 million is 3,243 people. Estates, those people are going to have a higher incentive to stay in Oregon because of the impact of this. Between $1.5 million and $2 million, again, a lower tax amount for those. That's 1,694 returns. Between $2 million and $3.5 million, still a lower amount for those estates under this bill. That's 1,567 returns. When you get over $3.5 million to $5 million, over the past 10 years, there's been 531 returns. Between $5 million and $10 million, 382 returns, and only 142 returns from $10 million to $20 million. So if you look at the numbers of people, there's a greater incentive here for just in terms of gross numbers of people, to stay put.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tupper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One, directly what you just said, Lane, on this table. But this table does not project its trend. It's historic. It doesn't it doesn't take into account the trillions of dollars that are going to be changing hands here as the population ages and starts leaving this world and going to the next. So this table may not even be relevant. But the other question I had was, you said you can't take the property with you. But you can.
You can. You can transfer to LLC.
You can do 1031s. You can sell. I mean, there's lots of ways you can. So somebody could, in fact, leave the state. This may be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and they say, okay, let's start structuring moving assets out of the state, moving me out of the state, moving all the capital gains that the state might recognize, all the employees that the state might recognize. So to clarify your comment that you can't take it with you, yes, you can.
Chair Berger, Senator Tupper, you're right. Except for personal property, or I mean, you have to take steps to do it.
And Madam Chair, and
so I should be claiming announcing a conflict of interest because this could make a lot of money doing this now. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, again, on that, on the issue of looking for back and looking forward on this chart, I mean, that is true. But I think that is also one of the reasons the state has periodically adjusted upward that exemption amount. And this one does move that exemption amount up another $500,000. And that, again, was part of what we were recognizing was that trend to increase that. And I think that probably will be an increasing trend, as you suggest, estates continue to grow in size with the great transfer of wealth that we'll be seeing in the next generation. But this one at least anticipates or takes that next step that Oregon has historically taken in years past of moving that exemption amount up to keep in time with or step with the times. And again, as you know, as to the impact of the estate tax, I think our sense was that that impact is there, and that changes in behavior that this bill would incent is really probably on the margins, given the impact that the estate tax already has just by the fact that we have it, and that we are the one of only two states that has it, and that of the two states, we are the estate that taxes at the lowest level of estate value. So we had in mind just this general sense that, all those disincentives to pay estate tax in Oregon are already part of the system, and that the changes we're making here are on the margin more helpful than unhelpful.
Madam Chair, just as in any tax system, there isn't the silver bullet, if you will, or it's not all honey, nor it's all vinegar, right? The states above certain limit, 3.6 million and above, have not improved that position. They actually have less incentive. If the idea was to move because of the tax rate, they have less incentive to stay. The ones that are below that threshold has improved their position according to these rates. But again, remember what we've done, and we put this in the revenue impact statement. The about 80% will have less payment under the new system than the old one, which means 20%, which is the highest levels of values that we're looking for, actually will be burdening a lot more. And here's comes with the idea of standard deviation and stuff. We're actually are increasing the standard deviation with the new system rather than decreasing. So it's a lot less stable system that we're producing than.
It's not. You mean a lot more stable?
A lot less stable.
Less stable.
Because you're relieving 80% of the payers from payment, and you're leaving only 20% to make up for it. So you're pushing. How would you say it? You're trying to hit a lot smaller target.
Oh, I see.
So sometimes you're gonna feel like you have no estate tax in the state some years, and some other years you're going to capture the big fish. I mean, the
now the big fish is right.
Okay.
And that's if the big fish are in the water.
Well, under the water or something, and catch in the makeup time. So,
okay. So along those lines, for the purpose of discussion, I assume that if you put the threshold down lower, then you would have a lower top rate.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. If you wanted to retain the $1 million threshold, you could do that. It would reduce the, and then you would be capturing, you would be back to capturing those 500, those estates between $1 million and $1.5 million, and that would have an impact on the rates. Again, just like Jeff says, if you're going to change one piece, then you would change something else. In that case, it would be the rates.
And if you did that, you would also have to adjust the natural resources.
Madam Chair, I think maybe not. Since the natural resource credit is, at least in this, a formula, it would be self-adjusting. I think my gut tells me it would be self-adjusting. If you lower the rate, that $6 million would be lower that to...
Okay, you could raise that back up.
Or raise that up to, raise that up to seven. Yeah.
But well, it would you wouldn't have to six change and a half.
Although that formula...
Six and a half, that's right, yeah.
That formula is not... I mean, revenue neutral compared to what we have today, so that's what we have to adjust to.
Right.
You're right, we have to adjust that.
Okay, all right. Other questions?
Senator, if I could just make one point on the change in the deduction. If you just look at the way that things are distributed over the a year, so for example, in 2008, the estates below $1.5 million made up about $10 million of the $75 million collected. So you lose that amount, you make it up at the top. If you bring back in the $1 million down to the $1 million exemptions, you bring the top level down some, but again, it's not a huge change overall. But of course, that's what Mazin's here for. So.
Yes, exactly. He has to have some purpose in life. Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very,
thank you.
Very much. And again, thank you for all your hard work on this. Okay. We are going to ask now for Clint Bentz, and we'll bring up Sarah Lyman with him.
The House did change the rates.
Because they were paying it up. Because
they weren't revenue neutral. Welcome.
Welcome.
So we have to ask you, are you related?
No.
Okay, now you can
us
hear
too?
No.
No, are you related,
I'm related
to our Clint Bentz?
Yes, I'm his cousin.
Okay.
So he and his dad and my dad were brothers.
Oh, okay. Well, if you could introduce yourself as your real self.
Yes. So Senator Burdick, Senator Morris, and the rest of the committee, my name is Clint Bentz. I'm a CPA, a partner with Bolt Carlisle Smith, accounting firm here in Salem. I'm also a member of the Oregon Small Business Association and was a voting member of the Oregon Law Commission that helped drafted this report. And I've passed out some testimony to you. I am a CPA and work in this area. I'm a tax practitioner, and actually my area especially is in the estate tax arena. And so this is something that I've been involved with for some time. I've also been here in the building quite a bit over the last several years working on the natural resource property part of the law. And so I had a great deal of interest in seeing this get fixed. So the charge to the committee was, first of all, to look, do we need to change Chapter 118? That was the first question that we asked, and we pulled around the room and said, absolutely, yes. Chapter 118 is a mess. It doesn't really work for the practitioners. It's hard to understand. I personally don't have a 2000 code book, federal code book, in my office. There's a whole bunch of stuff in that code book that isn't there anymore, the qualified family-owned business interest deduction. There's a whole bunch of stuff that just went away, but we have to actually compute the tax under that federal system in order to compute Oregon's tax. And so we have to get back, go back to 2000, figure out what the tax was, then federally, then figure out the Oregon tax, and it's just challenging. And I'm old enough that I actually remember 2000, but you know, the staff that I'm hiring now, I'm having to train them on a code that doesn't exist anymore. So that's a problem, and we need to fix it. And that was actually one of the challenges we had as we went through the commission was, for a great deal of time, we didn't actually have a federal inheritance tax. So what are we going to tie it to? So, but by the time got done, we had the new code, and we were able to tie it up to that new code. So that is really a big deal. I think another thing is that most Oregon taxpayers assume that the first $1 million is exempt from tax. It comes as a shock to them when, you know, they got $1,001,000, now they owe $33,000 in tax. It's a shock to the taxpayers. So you had a discussion here a little bit ago about, if we move this from $1.5 million down to $1 million, I mean, the real tax break occurred by removing $1.5 million out of every taxable estate. This is a tax break to every taxable estate. Even if you reduced it back to $1 million and but kept this exemption idea, it's still a $33,000 tax break to every taxable estate. That is going to need to be made up in the rates if we want to keep this revenue neutral. And so there's going to be a rate impact just even doing that. And so that's something to think about. since its inception, the natural resource property tax credit has been a challenge for everybody. It's been a challenge for the taxpayers and for the department.
And for the committee.
And for the committee, yeah. So yeah, we spent a lot of time talking about something that, you know, has very little revenue impact. But for the people that it matters to, it matters a great deal. And I'm one of those people. So I'm really thankful for the committee spending so much time working on this part of the code. And I think there's a good public policy reason to have this in the code. But we think that the multiple changes that we made to this finally make this part of the code workable for the practitioners and easier to administer for the department. So I think we've broken the back of the natural resource property credit problems in this code. And there's substantive changes to that area. Another thing I think is important is that people who file an extension or get an installment agreement, this is something that's come up in the tax court. Oregon has a 5% standard interest rate, and then it has a 4% penalty interest rate for underpayment or late payment of tax. That penalty interest rate is now being applied against people who have installment agreements or even extensions of time to file on their, you know, so they have a valid extension or they've entered an installment agreement. We're actually paying 9% interest rate on Oregon for those. So that's another part of this code that we fix that, so we pay interest but not the penalty rate. Finally, and this really impacted the natural resource property thing, but if you do have to file a federal return, we make certain elections on it for the marital property, special use valuation, alternate use valuation. There's a whole number of what expenses we put on the estate tax return, and all those are made to try to reduce the federal tax. Well, we come down to Oregon, we have a whole different set of drivers for try to reduce the tax. We said if we have two separate systems, really, when we file an Oregon return, we ought to be able to make our own elections, and we were not able to do that under current law. So this makes it clear we actually start with the federal number, but then we have additions and subtractions, just like we do with the income tax code, to come down to the Oregon taxable state, and we can change, make a different merit elections, make different special use elections, valuation elections. All those things are in this code. So after spending 2 years working on this, I'm really happy about this bill. I encourage you to support it. I know that there's challenges with the rate issues and other things, but we think if we're going to have an inheritance tax system in Oregon, which I think is a political question that was beyond the scope of this working group, but if we're going to have one, let's have a law that works, and this law does work. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Sarah Lyman. I live near Monroe, Oregon, and our family manages forest land in three counties in the Coast Range. And the natural resource exemption and the $1.5 million does matter to people like us. So appreciate that you recognize there's a lot of other people like us as well in the natural resource area. We have a three-generation family business, and our aim is to harvest what we grow each year. Yet the main value of our lands is out there in growing timber of all ages. So as I think it was Ms. Johnson said, we've always been known as land rich and cash poor, but that's the way we can keep it together, and we've been trying to do that. But when the next death in the family happens, I think that the inheritance tax is going to be pushing us toward our own tipping point, the point where you know, our delicate balance of only harvesting what we grow will be disrupted. I feel that the heirs will be encouraged to start liquidating more than the annual growth, and our careful management plans will be tipped so out of balance that I really believe that our family ownership and our business will likely fall apart, and the forest lands, you know, will have to be sold off, and we won't be able to keep harvesting every year because we will cut too much, and not having that income will cause us to probably fall apart. As most family businesses don't make it to the next generation, we really hope that we're going to be one of those families. I think, you know, keeping lands in natural resource use benefits the state as well as families. And we hope that we really think that this bill will help keep those natural resource lands in family ownership and in forest land. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we'll take
Peggy Woolsey, Jody Weiser, and Larry Scruggs. Welcome. Peggy, why don't you start out since you were a member of the work group?
Both of us were.
You were in the work group, Jody? I missed your name. How could I do that?
None of us, neither of us were official members of the work group.
Just observers.
We were observers. But we were active observers. Lane certainly didn't.
You were active? I can't believe that.
I know. No, but, you know, sometimes you feel like you're really in the audience. When we were at the Oregon Law Commission, we felt like we were part of the group and as things were progressing. So Jody Weiser with Pax Fairness Oregon. This bill passed the House, and it passed with concerns from both the Democrats and the Republicans. They were concerned that about the $700,000 revenue impact, which actually appeared for everybody the day it was leaving the House Revenue Committee. So it was kind of a surprise, but it was moving, and it moved. And Sarah Gelsa really was the carrier of Democrat concerns, and 14 Republicans voted against the bill in the House as well. And their concerns were mostly that the bill didn't go far enough to eliminate the estate tax. We think this bill has significant flaws that need to be corrected. And we do have some amendments that we got back just before this session. We don't have a copy of the bill, so we couldn't make sure they were exactly what we were looking for, but we think that you should look at them. The biggest problem with 2541A is that it would give Oregon the second highest estate tax in the nation. Only Indiana would have a tax rate higher than ours. And there are only four states of the 19 with estate taxes that have a rate above 16%. The rest have rates below 16%. And by and large, $1 million exemption is the common exemption across the country. So basically now, 1% of estates actually pay Oregon estate tax. And under the change to $1.5 million exemption, a half of 1% would pay the estate tax. We're not sure what the problem is that's being solved there, because being in the top 1% is not being middle class. You know, it's $1 million exemption for most families means, most of the time it's a family, it means a $2 million exemption. And if only 1% of Oregonians are dying with that much money, it's hard to see why we would need to change it to half of 1%. The changes to the natural resources portion of the bill is where the revenue impact is. It affects only 25 to 30 estates each year. And that, the direction was to make this bill revenue neutral, and that isn't yet revenue neutral. We just need to keep working on it. And we're still exploring this whole thing about intangibles, because it could be that as we were trying to figure this out, we actually made it so that someone with an estate like mine could very easily pay taxes on nothing but their house, because everything else becomes an intangible. And we want to make sure that wasn't the intention of the committee, and we want to make sure that intention is correct. And we do have a national estate tax lawyer looking at it, someone whose own clients would be unaffected by what the Oregon law is. There are many good points to the bill, and we are proud to be working on dealing with some of those problems and coming to ways to solve them. The cliff, obviously, is one of them. Connecting to a law for which there are law books available is another one. Creating procedures related to the collection of taxes that work better, clarifying the elections, and repealing obsolete language and provisions were all things that we're glad to see done. But none of that is time critical. It may be too difficult to understand and fix the problems identified during the session. We do have amendments we'd be happy to share with you, but it may be that you want to send it back to the Law Commission to work on some more. we need to be sure that you need to give them clear directions. I don't think they felt like they had a direction from you that said don't raise the exemption or don't raise the top rate and put us outside the norm in the country. But when almost everybody else has a 16% rate, and we would, it's not a good talking point for the first class section of airport of airplanes to say we have the second highest estate tax in the country. Making sure that the natural resources section is actually revenue neutral. Some ideas that we had for how to do that would include removing from the definition all the homes and home sites and rental properties that end up accumulating on farms. Our farm started with no house, and then it had a house, and then as we purchased other land, we got other houses, because originally that community was a community of smaller farmers, and everybody had 80 acres and a house. And we had some structures we took down because they weren't worth maintaining, and we made that acre they were setting on back into farmland. But in other cases, we had rental properties. And there's really no particular reason why a farm or forest estate should include the value of the home and the home site, especially when you think of some of the small boutique farms that we have that actually farm Christmas trees in order to farm a lower property tax and a lower income tax. And this bill, the natural resources portion of the bill, as we wrote it in, what was that, 2007, actually makes those structures part of the natural resource part of the state. And I'm not sure that's good policy. Another solution might be to change the amount of operating capital from 20% to 10% or 7% or some other number. If you think about a $1 million house on 26 acres with Christmas trees, that $1 million house is worth $200,000 worth of operating expenses. Doesn't really make sense. Or just redoing the chart. And of course, you could just eliminate the natural resource selection section of the bill, but not everybody would go along with that. We do think that we need to make sure that we have included intangibles in the ways we want to include intangibles, or we might have just created a huge hole that everybody can drive their truck through without much effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Want to talk now?
Sure. For the record, I am Peggy Woolsey of Tax Fairness, Oregon, also the retired inheritance tax auditor for the state of Oregon. This bill, the Law Commission did a fabulous job on cleaning up a lot of confusing, conflicting, outdated language and statutes. Makes the law a lot easier to administer for the Department of Revenue and the current auditor. I always had a problem with raising the rate from $1 million, because currently at $1 million, it works out that only 1% of our decedents have to pay an inheritance
tax. Peggy, if you could not duplicate the testimony right. that you just got, uh-huh. got given, I'm getting a little sensitive about time here.
Okay. I am also aware of the fact that at $1 million, our rates are quite different. I do see that besides the 19 states that have an estate tax, there are also about 10 others that have an inheritance tax. And that also increases the overall effect that these kinds of death taxes or transfer taxes might have across the country. I liked the progressive rates with the ramp instead of a cliff. I am concerned that that with having the second highest rates, we might be incenting people to do some creative estate planning. I believe that the federal election on the marital property should follow with the Oregon return. It makes it a bit easier to track everything. But I do realize the majority of the people on the Oregon Law Commission didn't feel the same. They wanted to be able to manipulate the numbers a little easier. With the natural resource property, the benefit is about 1 to 2% of what we collect every year. And with this kind of a tax expenditure, I think we need a sunset. The bill clarified the issues with the interest and the statute of limitations, and I really appreciate all the good work that the committee did. I felt that none of us got exactly what we wanted, so there probably is a lot of good stuff in the bill. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, members of the committee. My name is Larry Scruggs. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm also here with Tax Fairness Oregon. First of all, I would like to thank you for the limits that you're proposing, because I'm right in the middle of it, and you guys have the potential to save me a lot of money, which we have been planning for some time. But coupled with that, I'd like to point out that I believe very strongly in having a strong estate tax to help prevent the accumulation of wealth by the few over generations. I think that's absolutely necessary to protect our republic and to provide everybody with the opportunity to succeed. I'll make my complete comments are submitted electronically, so let me just make one more salient point, because I know time is an issue. At the present time in Oregon, the lowest 20% of income levels pay state and local taxes at a rate of about 8.7%, while the highest income level pays a rate of about 7.3%. We think that's backwards. We think that you need to invert that tax system so we have a more progressive tax system, so that those who benefit more from the society pay at a higher rate than those who benefit less. And coupled with that, we need to get about the business of revising the entire tax system here in the state of Oregon. We've been talking about this for how many years now? And we're still going about it in a piecemeal process. And we really think it's time to, let's get about the business of putting the whole fiscal house in order. And with that, I'll close my remarks. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Morse.
Question, Madam Chair. Thank you. 8.7% of what?
It's of taxable income, but it's state and local taxes.
It's not the total tax paid. It's a percent of their income?
Yes, it's income. Yeah. Oregon state and local tax paid.
If you look at all the taxes and fees and you divide them up into the 20%, who pays what, the bottom 20% pays a higher percentage in state and local, a higher percentage of their income from state and local taxes, and that wealthiest 20% pays the lower. Mm-hmm. And this obviously changes to the estate tax that let people out of it are going to just make that work more so.
Other questions? Thank you. Okay, now we'll take Scott Russell and Rex Storm.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Russell, and our family owns timberland in Columbia County, and I'm current president of Columbia County Small Woodlands Association. One of the things I'd like to start out with, and I'll make my comments quite short, is that Oregon produces more softwood than any other state in the Union, produces more plywood than any other state in the Union, and it produces almost twice as much as the plywood as the state that's in second place. So this natural resource is very significant, and I think all of us need to take this very seriously. I think this bill is very necessary in order to preserve these farms. The number of farms in our county where when somebody passes away, they end up having to cut half of their resource in order to pay taxes is not an incentive for my kids to take over my farm. In fact, my kids are working in other industries, and they're not getting the benefit of my knowledge and our family's knowledge in keeping that farm going. And that's the real critical element. When you lose that next generation, you've lost a lot of the value of the farm. We have bought land that was originally cut up into development land, and there was no harvesting on that for many years. We are putting that back into production. So when we talk about the tax neutrality, I don't know that we are considering the number of jobs and the number of, and the amount of income tax that will be produced by keeping these farms in the families. It's quite, excuse me, it's quite easy to have a 50-acre farm meet that $1.5 million valuation. So the larger farms are going to need this to keep going, and there's a scale of size that's required in order to have a farm that will produce. The way I see it is money is actually created by combining natural resources with labor, and you need to retain these farms in order to produce that income. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Storm.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I am Rex Storm. I'm a second-generation family forest land owner, and I reside in Washington County. My wife and I own 94 acres of commercial forest land located in Columbia and Washington counties. Our income, however, comes from two full-time jobs. We own this forest land for two purposes, for one, for retirement income, and secondly, to instill in our children the legacy of land management, which they could someday inherit. I learned this from my father. We hope to acquire more land for this purpose, but frankly, Oregon's punitive estate death taxation discourages me from purchasing more forest land that would grow wealth, which upon my demise, the state would take a portion of instead of my children reaping my legacy. I'm here today to support House Bill 2541A as a better way to reward my family's commitment to forest land management for our relatively small estate, which is valued at less than $3 million. The current Oregon death tax estates over $1 million is a terrible disincentive for my family forest land owners and other family forest land owners like my wife and me. The current death tax teaches my children the perverse lesson that one should not invest in the toils into forestry in land management, because the state will take much of that away. The state would take much of that away if we were too successful, if we were to manage our forest well, or if one of the parents dies, if the parents die. Oregon's death tax now punishes families like mine who are just trying to get ahead doing good forest management. Forest management decisions should be based on sound forestry, not on government forest harvest to pay the tax man when dad dies and the appraisal comes in over $1 million. This is wrong. House Bill 2541 should create a more practical balance, and we support this balance that 2541 creates. This is a proposed adjustment, and it would honor my family in its commitment to forest land management. And we would like our children to learn the respect for working the land, because it is a noble and worthwhile cause. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Okay, now we'll take David Bean and Don Sparks.
Thank you. My name is David Bean, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee, and Senator Morse. I moved here 30 years ago because of men with your title and your name, and I'd just like to honor that. Very good thinking. I hope to reflect that. I will only do a shabby bit. I come here concerned with a number of sides of this debate. I'm interested in the prosperity of Oregon, and I know its uniqueness. Oregon and Washington do provide the majority of the softwood for the country. And good management is the key to that standing. And the management of trees requires looking at the soil and the natural inputs, which include salmon. And I don't wish to go far afield here, but But true management of Douglas fir is between 175 and 215 years, according to Gordon Robinson, who was the head forester for Southern Pacific, and for 30 years produced both more cut and more wood standing by his multi-use, multi-species, multi-year management system, which is in the book Excellent Forestry, The Forest and the Trees. I don't believe that family traditions are very important, but I don't think that they can be used as a management principle to go over that span of time. And I would just wish in further looking at the estate tax that this span of time with regard to trees is dealt with in a formal state fashion, and I wish I had the answer of how to do it. So my sentiments are there, and I know that as a carpenter that good wood comes from old trees, and old trees also sequester a whole lot more carbon, which is good for global warming, and they also do not burn so frequently. And our current financial setting is the formula for injecting as much carbon as possible through these baby trees burning over and over again and the despoilment of the soil. That's a serious concern that we pay every summertime. On the other hand, I'm also concerned about prosperity for all we Oregonians, and I'm aware of the concentration of wealth where last year in the United States, 25% of the population, 1% of the population earned 25% of the wealth and controlled 40%. The way to rectify that as fairly as possible is through the estate tax. And my head hurts when I hear about revenue neutrality with regard to the estate tax when we're in a $4 billion budget hole.
We're going to have to ask you to conclude your
remarks. Okay. Well, I conclude saying that the ramp in this in this bill is very is a very positive move.
Thank
in
you.
Terms of and I'll conclude.
Thank you.
I'm Don Sparks. I live in Milwaukee. I have a commercial property there, and I have a tree farm in Washington County. The commercial, I'm quite small, and I'll be plain with you that the tax, even at the highest rates here, the $1 million exemption, and for a single person, and the 16% rate are not a worry to me. They're not a problem to me. I own a duplex. I live in one side. I have one renter. The problems that I have to do with are with regulation in a totally different area. All the regulations that I have to deal with, even though I only have one rental. At the tree farm, again, it's regulation, environmental regulations. I have two streams.
If you would just comment on the bill, that'd be great.
Okay. And so my concern with the bill is that I would like to see it stay at a $1 million exemption rather than going to $2 million. And stay progressive, more progressive with a larger tax base, 1% of the estates, not 1% of the population, 1% of the estates, and the lower tax rate. I think that would be more fair and more progressive. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we will have Sean Cleave, Patrick Kepper, Jim James and Roger Byer. They're all in the same handwriting, so I assume they all want to come up at once. We have only three chairs, so you can figure out how to deal with that.
We have four chairs.
Now we have four chairs. Still only have two mics.
Four chairs off.
Chair Burdick, Members of the committee, my name is Patrick Happer of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. You have my written testimony, but just to touch on a few things, we've worked closely with the Law Commission through this process. This bill has been on the table for a number of years, and we believe that this bill gets us close to where we want to be in an effort to where it works for everyone. We understand the issue of revenue neutrality, and with such a volatile tax structure, it's difficult to get there. And I think that's reflected in the fiscal, and some others might touch on that and go into a little bit more detail. We commend the hard work that has gone into this by the Law Commission over the last several months. There's been a lot of sweat equity that's gone into this, a lot of hard work. With that being said, this is a top priority for the nurseries. This is a bill that we care deeply about that would help our members a lot. So we urge your support. I will just add one other thing. I know we're running short on time, but we do have some concerns with a number of groups that have kind of come in late in the game that we're hearing about that weren't involved early on in the process, that are now adamantly opposed, that didn't have a voice early on. We feel it would have been beneficial for everyone if we could have heard some of those concerns early on. Perhaps they could have been addressed. And I just wanted to get on the record that we are concerned that some of those issues are coming up late after so much work has been done on the House and with the Law Commission. And with that, I'll conclude and take any questions.
Thank you. Let's go next.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau has about 7,100 family farms to which are members of the Farm Bureau in Oregon. The Farm Bureau also supports this legislation wholeheartedly. We participated in the work group with the Oregon Law Commission. We'd like to thank Ms. Johnson and Mr. Shetterly for their work. I think a lot was said earlier on of the importance of this piece of legislation for putting clear parameters around the Oregon Natural Resource Tax Credit. That credit is the majority of interest for the farming community. I think, to echo Mr. Capper, we've ended up in a place with this legislation that does provide 99% of what the agricultural community would be looking for in a working model for Oregon statutes. And I will wrap up my testimony and do any questions that the committee might have. So,
thank you. Let's go next.
Jim. Yeah. Chairman Burdick and committee, my name is Jim James. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and OSWA does support this bill. And I guess there's one policy or a public policy issue that I'd just like to reemphasize that some of our members already made, and that is the travesty that when there's a death in the family, that there's unintended consequences of the management of a forest where unexpected harvest or unplanned harvest has to take place to pay the tax bill. And again, the Natural Resource Tax Credit helps get over that policy, which I believe is not in the best interest of the state of Oregon or for its environment or for its economy. Decisions are made that aren't good economical decisions, and I believe the state would generate more revenue over time if landowners did not have to make that very, very poor choice. So anyway, we support the bill, and we hope that you will give it due consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing Oregon Small Woodlands, Oregon Dairy Farmers, and Oregon Seed Council, all of which greatly support this bill. We appreciate the work that's gone into this bill and hope you will look favorably upon it. Specifically, like you heard from the other members of this panel, the Natural Resources Credit is probably the most crucial thing to all those groups. From a personal standpoint, you can understand in a timber organization, and I know Senator Burdick, you knew or know former Representative Larry Soa. His family was a neighbor of mine. When his parents were killed, his father died, his mother was killed in a car wreck before he had an opportunity to do their estate planning, they had to liquidate all the timber assets on the property. A bill like this would be very beneficial for family forest landowners, just as you've heard about. This is it can be devastating to a family when that happens, and it's not because of lack of planning. In his case, it was the case that they just hadn't got the paperwork signed yet. So we understand the rate increase for some of the larger estates in the state may be problematic, but at the same time, with adequate planning, and which most of the larger states have at their disposal, those tax bills can be minimized, maybe not eliminated, but they can be minimized. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can, and thank you for the hearing the bill, and thank you to the Law Commission for doing the good work.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Okay, final panel, Kevin Mannix, Patrick Story, and David Roth.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm a former legislator. I'm an attorney in Salem. Pardon me. And while we are a trifecta in appearance, we come here independently to appear in front of you today. I am speaking as a citizen. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Common Sense for Oregon Incorporated organization, which is a 501c4 advocacy organization. I've just turned in written testimony, which I will not replicate, but I will highlight a few points. First of all, we appreciate the Oregon Law Commission and the fine work that they do. Second of all, the procedural work done in this bill is just fine. The problem that we have is that this bill combines the substantive with the procedural. There are substantive policy changes that are intertwined in this legislation that have a major impact on the economy of the state, on keeping jobs, and I'm bringing jobs to this state. We've heard testimony about the estate tax rate that would apply here in Oregon and whether or not this will exceed Indiana or whatever. Attached to my testimony, you'll see a February 2011 Wall Street Journal editorial described as death tax ambush, where it talks about states of confiscation. And they applied what they thought would be the effective Oregon rate, and we were at 45.4 on that scale. However, with this legislation, with a 19.8% top rate, I believe we will exceed even Indiana. Right now, if you take a look at the states of this nation and look back 10 years, in 2001, a Revenue Committee report pointed out that all 50 states had estate taxes in 2001. In the last 10 years, 27 or 28 states have eliminated those taxes. I cite two different sources. It might be 28, it might be 27. We're down to 22 or 23 states that still have taxes. In this bill, we will be in the position of advertising ourselves as the one state west of the Mississippi, along with Washington, two states total, that have an estate tax, but we're going to best the state of Washington because we'll have a trifecta. We will have a high capital gains tax. We will have a high income tax, and we will have what appears to be the highest effective ultimate estate tax rate in the United States. And then we want to ask people to come to Oregon to invest and to create jobs. Better yet, we don't want to have our people leave. But the effect of this legislation will be to send an invitation to those who are running family-owned businesses, which create 90% of the jobs in the state, to please leave, do your estate planning, arrange for somebody else to buy your family business, because otherwise you are going to pay a tremendous penalty. We heard about natural resources industries, and no, you can't move natural resources, but you can move the ownership. What we are doing are taking ourselves out of competition for jobs with the substantive part of this bill. And I'd implore the committee to consider the opportunity to tell the Law Revision Commission there are wonderful things you've done procedurally. Yes, current statutes actually refer in a few places to death taxes, quote, unquote, politically incorrect. We have combined references to inheritance taxes and estate taxes. It's all very confusing. We're connected to a 2000 code. We need to understand all of those things can be addressed procedurally without changing effective tax rates. The the exemption or the protection that we have for natural resources in the code is a good thing. And yes, it needs to be clarified, but not at the cost of destroying our job-keeping and job-making capability in this state. And there is a real harm in being number one on that list. Now, in the interest of time, I will only mention a couple of other points because I think they have to come out. Talking about the capability to use the federal tax deduction to reduce the impact of our tax, that federal code provision is only in effect for 2011 and 2012. We have no idea what's going to happen January 1, 2013 in terms of the federal estate tax law. So to attach ourselves to that shining star and say, well, it won't be too bad because of that credit, we don't know what's going to happen. Congress has got to deal with it. We're waiting to see. But in the meantime, let's not depend on something that's not going to exist after January 1, 2013. And my last point, the substantive changes in this bill intertwined with the procedural changes are retroactive. We talk about estate tax planning and all of that, but then we say, if you've died since January 1 of this year, regardless of whatever you did in previous years, depending on the Oregon tax code, we're now going to apply a new substantive law to you. In some cases, there will be winners. In some cases, there will be losers. We're robbing Peter to pay Paul. The rest of this is covered by my written submission, and I thank you for the opportunity to appear today.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
sure. My name is David Roth. Greetings to the committee, Chairman Burdick, and the rest of you senators. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here. I'm primarily concerned about the lower end of that change that Mr. Mannix is referring to. It's the change, the raise in the a threshold of tax liability for estates that to compensate for has drives up the rate on the higher sized estates. I'm here because to express the point of view that I and my mother share, my mother who died in 2009, concerning this situation, because if this bill had been in place when she died in 2009, it would have significantly affected the estate tax liability. It would have relieved the tax costs significantly because she'd reached the point through a lot of scrimping and a good pension and some fortunate real estate investments to the point where she had an estate at her death of about $3 million. She had, in contrast, grown up in a prosperous middle-class family in the East that was broken up by the Depression. I mean broken up because her father left the family not long after he lost his job with the city where they worked, they lived. However difficult life was during those years, she knew that millions of other Americans had it much worse, and that's why she was grateful and proud of the economic reforms of the New Deal that protected American citizens from the ravages of a poorly regulated economic system. After my father was killed in the war, she moved from the East to the West Coast. Specifically, she told me not long ago, before she died, that because she knew that the West Coast had much more developed public institutions than the East Coast had for historical reasons, especially their grand public universities and colleges. And it was through those colleges and universities that she acquired a bachelor's in economics.
Mr. Roth, I'm going to have to ask you to kind of shorten this up. We're
Pardon
almost
me.
Out of time.
All right. I understand. Let me get my point being that my mother, as a person with an estate like this, was deeply concerned about the need for progressive income, progressive taxation in order to prevent the excessive accumulation of wealth and power in the country. Let me close by pointing out an irony that I think you've probably encountered in your discussions with lobbyists and proponents of this bill. You've probably heard that you need to raise the threshold at the lower end because, after all, $1 million really isn't much anymore. Let me point out what $1 million represents from the standpoint of the rest of the people in the state economy. As you know, the median income is about, in Oregon, for a family is about $50,000. For a family at the median, to be able to just earn $50 million in altogether, whether it would remain not apart from an estate, would require 20 years of employment. Clearly, more than half of most people's working lives would be required for a person at the middle in Oregon to achieve $1 million. It seems to me that for someone to argue that $1 million really doesn't deserve to be taxes because it's not that substantial, an inheritance represents an attitude of entitlement and privilege, which I really think this committee would not want to endorse.
Thank you. Mr. Story, take us home.
Patrick Story, thank you for this opportunity. I will be very brief. I will address only Section 7, which we've heard so much about. And the Law Commission even mentioned that they dealt with it with rough justice, which suggests to me that it's still open for discussion. To get to the point, it is a tax expenditure for natural resource property, farm use, forest land, and fishing. And I think it should be addressed with a sunset. And that's because it should be periodically reviewed, just as business tax breaks for research and development and enterprise zones or tax breaks that support families or the 529 College Savings Network. It deserves that kind of scrutiny should it remain in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? And thank you for keeping it short. It's always hard batting cleanup in this committee. Okay. Thank you very much. There's nobody else signed up. Is there anybody else who wants something quick to say on this? Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2541, and we are adjourned. We are adjourned.